This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 112. Brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Ryan Weeks to talk about the all-important recent FCA review of the P2P industry and some draconian proposals which could potentially change the face of the industry. Ryan is a long-term editor of Alt-Fi's sectoral news coverage, host of the Millennial Money Matters podcast, brackets now resting brackets, and published fiction author of the snappily entitled Pimple, which is currently getting 19 out of 19 five-star reviews on Amazon. Regulation is the jelly mold that creates markets in the old world and in the modern world. Last year, we had the last chairman of the FSA and chairman of the global Basel III committee, Lord Turner, talking openly and critically about banking regulation. Separately, I've been on the case for years now, trying to track down the right person to talk about FS regulation per se, and hopefully we will see something soon, or rather hear something soon. There's a real constitutional problem with regulation. It has mushroomed over the past 20 years in terms of cost and volume to proportions that would have been totally unimaginable even when I started my career. The part of the state called regulators has huge powers over all sectors of the economy from telecoms to FS. In the 80s, the zeitgeist was of privatisation, liberating industries from the leaden and uncommercial hand of the state. Now, companies are still private, however, the leaden hand has come in through the back door. This is a huge topic in itself, which I merely note in passing for today. But consider this, regulators are unelected, unaccountable, and undemocratic. Yet, as we shall see today, they totally control the development of, in this case, a key sector of fintech. More broadly, of course, the permanent state, and in the US anyway these days, the not-so-deep, deep state, have accumulated a huge amount of power in the late 20th century. It's a problem of deepest constitutional importance. After all, if we take the law, which is the nearest example, where unelected and pretty unaccountable judges can create laws themselves in an undemocratic way, this has for centuries been whittled down, or millennia even, to evolve enough checks and balances to keep people and their pitchforks away. But not yet regulation. So, pitchforks for the moment can stay in your barns, comrades. And before we propose a bonfire of the vanities, let's dive into the FCA's review of peer-to-peer. Which proposals do we, the people, approve of? Which proposals shall be thrown onto the bonfire of state vanities? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about podcasts. You did a very good podcast, I thought, called Millennial Money Matters. You spoke to the elders of society, the old and wise, who gave you sort of very good avuncular advice, half of which you took. And I think one of the good pieces of advice you were given, which is it's a bit of a marathon, so don't set off at 100-metre pace. And you took this into account, but you set off at 200-metre pace.
Yes, I did not heed the warning, Mike, and I'm sorry not to have, because as you say, Millennial Money Matters is now on a slight hiatus, having knocked out sort of 19 or 20 episodes within about 6 months or maybe a year. The idea behind it was that it was all about sort of presenting new financial technology ideas and how they might help younger people. And it was supposed to be very hot on jargon. So I had a little bell and I would ring if ever, you know, Adam French, who was running Scalable Capital at the time, talked about whatever it was that he did at Goldman Sachs. So yeah, no, I thought it was quite successful and I may sort of resume it later on, but it is on pause for now.
I thought it was very successful, actually. I thought it was very well done, very clear. And I'd certainly encourage you to, you know, just to sort of keep it ticking over on a monthly basis, because, well, I'll ask you what a millennial is in a minute, but there are plenty of people out there who just need to know, in a sense, a few simple apps and a little bit of insight. I mean, I did one with TransferGo a couple of episodes ago, and they do FX transfers for 99p and, you know, a decent spread off the mid-market. And my elder daughter's come back from ranching in America, and she's got several thousand dollars she needs to transfer. So how do people find out about this in the world of a million apps? So I get very confused, all this millennials and Gen X's and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So are you a millennial or are you a Gen X? And is one of those snowflakes and the other's not? Will you melt if I say the wrong thing?
Well, I think I am a millennial, but I have to say it's more than anything a snappy sort of tagline for the podcast.
An alliteration.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I haven't thought about it too deeply. I suppose I'm sort of thinking 20 to 35 year olds, broadly speaking, when I say millennials, because I think that about fits the technical definition. But I'm not precious about it.
But youngsters like you, when you were in your cradle, you were given sort of iPads which already existed and did internets, weren't you?
Yeah, well, something like that.
I think that's the main phase change, is that there are a generation of people who've grown up with all this sort of technology around them, for better and for worse.
I think that is the idea. And then, you know, there's a cutoff, I think, where you're no longer a millennial, you're whatever, is it a Gen Xer or whatever? And, you know, they're the people who grown up with Instagram and social media. And obviously, social media really only became a thing for me in my mid-teens or something like that, which isn't quite growing up with it. You know, my fiance is a teacher. The level to which some of these younger people, as young as 10, engage with social media now is just completely beyond anything that I've ever experienced.
Yes, that's true. And going back to who guards the guards, we're seeing a pretty active, I was about to use the word debate, it's not a debate, pretty active hoo-ha at the moment about the fact that the world always tends towards totalitarianism. I like Screaming Lord Hutch's contribution to political philosophy in the UK when he said, why is there only one monopolies commission? Well, we have one FCA, as we will come on to, and they regulate, and we have slightly more social media platforms, but there's only two or three of them.
Yes.
And they are clearly deciding who shall have the right speak in the modern public square and who shan't, which is a serious concern. And apart from my cynicism of how poorly the world is being run at the moment, either they are like alt-fi news publishers, in which case you can be held responsible for what you have on your platform, or they're mere conduits.
Yes.
But at the moment, they seem to be wanting to be both things. So in terms of this new world of technology and all this kind of stuff, as listeners know, because I keep moaning about it all the time, I've been involved in a little bit of writing myself this year. I'm at the stage where I rather wish I hadn't started. And I found that, of course, one very important thing, which shouldn't surprise anyone, is that research is terribly important to write a good book. And as that you're now a published author with fantastic reviews on Amazon, clearly you found yourself that research was terribly important, which is probably a good time to come on to the subject of pimple, which is not actually about complexion.
Yeah.
And how did you get that past the fiancé, the research?
Yes. So what I would say about Pimple is, first and foremost, a satire. For those that don't know, it's a book about an app which is effectively a sort of an Uber for the sex trade, so connecting prostitutes and punters in real time. And the reason for writing it was to sort of poke fun at disruptive technology more generally. So what I would say is that the bulk of the research actually was about disruptive technology rather than about whatever it is that Mike is hinting
at. OK, I have no further questions, my lord. The witness may stand down, as he's clearly admitted that not all of the research was about technology, and therefore a large part of it must have been about the prostitution industry and how things fit in there.
Lots of reading and writing and things like that.
So you're saying that secondary research, that you're claiming no primary research in the matter.
If that works, yeah.
Anyway, it clearly did very good research, whether it's secondary or primary, or whether it's a friend of a friend, because you do have these staggeringly good reviews, either that or you have 19 relatives.
Yeah. No, I mean, there certainly are some people on Amazon who've written reviews who I know, and there are, you know, a couple, let's say probably five, who I've never heard of. So, yeah, it's really good. I mean, I think that, you know, I think the reality is that were the book to do really well and become more and more popular, obviously there would be less rosy reviews cropping up, just as the nature of anything getting to scale. But, you know, I'm really open to feedback on it. So the ones that are slightly critical, I actually find, in a way, more valuable.
Yes, although I don't think any is critical at the moment, as they're all five star. And I did see this morning, just briefly looking, actually, to see where it's got to by now, that it's something like, I don't know, $10.99 or something for the book, and 99p for Kindle, which seemed incredibly cheap.
Yeah.
So obviously there's a whole pricing strategy there in terms of the ratio of the physical product to the virtual product, going back to your virtual interest.
What's really strange, actually, is that on the Amazon marketplace, there are several used copies.
Used copies of a novel about prostitution.
Yeah. On sale for about $14.99, which I can't work out at all. It sounds a bit vainglorious, but when we did the book launch, you know, there was the sort of a novel opportunity to sign a few. So I wonder if people have sort of valued my signature at £4.99 and put them on sale on the Amazon marketplace.
Good question. Have to buy one to find out yourself. Well, there's a whole thing about algorithmic pricing, which is a huge problem for my research, because I occasionally come across a book I need, like Chandra 1965, and find it's £296, even though it was re-released by Routledge in 1998. Right. Okay, so I take a deep breath. I had a coffee, but sadly it's about an hour and a half ago. Regulation, peer-to-peer, FCA, mumble, mumble, mumble. A few years ago I had Jonathan Siegel, the lawyer, on the show, and he was talking about the fact that even then, the fact that the regulation had come in meant that you could turn up at the FCA with your idea of being a triangle, and they'd listen to you very patiently and explain what a triangle was, three sides, blah, blah, blah. And then they say, yes, great, excellent. So are you a square or a circle? Mm. In that regulation is this jelly mold. It is kind of a pigeonhole into which things fit. And historically, there's lots of propaganda about how wonderful it is, yada, yada, yada. In practice, it may start off wonderful, and it's been very supportive over here, and it's been part of the market's growth, and we haven't seen the problems of China, so it has been successful. However, rust never sleeps, nor do regulators, and regulators keep nibbling away. They do stuff now, they'll do stuff in 5 years' time, they'll do stuff in 10 years' time. And there is a process of regulatory creep across the world, and I can't actually see, and this is one for another one, but I can't actually see what the countervailing force is. I can't see what democratic process or what constitutional process says, okay, regulators, you've gone far enough, or let's cut out half the regulation. I mean, David Cameron came in and wanted to do that. I'm not sure he has. Trump came in and wanted to do that. I'm not sure he has. But very briefly, can you just give the listeners a little bit of background on, historically, how peer-to-peers, how online lending and borrowing was regulated, or rather it wasn't regulated, and then briefly it was, and then kind of where we've got to at the moment, because as we all know, things that several years ago in your conferences would have been called peer-to-peer, some of them aren't.
Yeah, sure. So when first peer-to-peer lenders emerged, they launched into a regulatory vacuum.
Which would be around 2012, wouldn't it, or something? Or 2005 for Zoba.
Well, 2005 for Zoba, 2010 for Funding Circle, and Rate Setter and Market Invoice shortly after. And an organisation was formed, which I'm sure has been talked about on your show before, the Peer-to-Peer Finance Association, formed by Zoba and Funding Circle. Soon enough, they had a number of other members join. And that was joined basically to lobby for sector-specific regulation. And in 2014, I think it was, they got it. That was the beginning of the interim regime, and it applied to crowdfunding, and the regulators split the industry into two types. So it was investment-based and loans-based crowdfunding, which is kind of funny because no one actually uses the term loan-based crowdfunding apart from the regulator. Everyone else calls it peer-to-peer lending, but whatever. The investment-based side of crowdfunding applies to equity crowdfunding platforms like Crowdcube and Seeders, but also to bond-based platforms and debentures platforms such as Downing Crowd, Abundance is another one, the renewable energies platform, and there are several more. So that's the sort of the layout of it. And from, I think it was 2016 sometime, many of the platforms started to get fully authorised. So from that stage on, it was no longer an interim regime. Platforms were fully authorised by the FCA. And at that time, the regulator also promised that there would be a post-implementation review. So their regime was alive, but they promised that I think they initially promised 2017, in the summer of 2017, they would review their rules after, you know, a couple of years of being implemented and see how they were functioning and see what they might have to change. And that review, it has to be said, got very significantly delayed. Initially, I think it was the snap election that delayed it, to give you an idea of how long ago or how long it's been delayed.
And just in passing, for people hard of thinking like me, why does an election delay the FCA doing anything, speaking to prep forms?
That's a very fair question. But the most I was able to get out of the FCA as a journalist covering this was, we're in Perda, you know, during the snap election period. And I'm sure there are a few journalists listening to the podcast. Try asking anything of the FCA. You're not going to get a particularly in-depth answer.
Which comes back to, importantly, because this does get glossed over, it comes back to the serious question over accountability. I mean, reading some of your articles over the last couple of months on this topic, of course, you get quotes from senior figures in the peer-to-peer industry. And the average one of those is, you know, we welcome this, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This is upon the whole positive steps. You know,
yes,
we all benefit from the good market, da, 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 da. But quibble, quibble. And I've mentioned many times over the last few years, surprise, surprise, you know, this kind of language is passim in FS as a whole. You hear it in banking. But you go for a beer with some of these people and they use rather more Anglo-Saxon kind of stuff. You know, there is a real culture that you've got to be deferential to these people because they've got the sort of sword of Damocles hanging over your head. You know, woe betide you if you're a platform and you come out and say, this is a heap of shit.
Yeah.
You know, funny enough, your approvals might take a bit longer, which is a challenge, shall we say?
Well, I'll tell you, the only people that you tend to get sort of inflammatory quotes from about the regulator are people running smaller businesses, you know, sort of scrappier startups, because it feels, I guess, to an extent, like they've got nothing to lose anyway. Whereas obviously from the larger businesses, you know, the Funding Circles, the Zopas, whatever, you know, they're very unlikely to come out in opposition to a particular regime change or anything, unless it's done in a kind of a very organized way. It would almost be a campaign about something very specific. And actually, I can't bring one to mind.
So on that one, actually, because we're getting diverted, but it's an interesting big picture before we just get back to the detail, because, you know, you'll come up with various details and people say, oh, yeah, that's silly, or no, I can see the point, or whatever, is what we then get, because it's part of the evolution of fintech as a whole. What we're then seeing, or what we are now seeing, is the evolution into just any other sector where there's kind of, I'll use the word, collusion, the semi-collusion between the regulator and the industry. The regulator can't sort of beat the industry to death. Yep. It doesn't have any job to do. Equally, it like has to use its sort of stick, and you know, the industry doesn't like being beaten. But a bit like at school, as long as those teachers don't abuse their authority too much, you kind of go along with it. Yeah. It's only if the teachers are out of order that you start burning the place down.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it comes back to that point about having something to lose. I mean, you know, when you get to a particular size and you're beginning to size up things like IPOs and whatever else, you don't want to upset the apple cart.
Absolutely, right. So talking of apples then, I did interrupt you, and you were saying that when the initial regulation came in, it created categories. So we have peer-to-peers, and we have things like LendInvest, and Christian was on recently, and that aren't peer-to-peers. So very briefly, what is the topology? So going back to using the phrase P2P loosely, as it was several years ago, or more precisely, online lending and borrowing. You can go onto a website and you can lend money, you can borrow money. What kind of categories are there?
Within peer-to-peer?
Well, peer-to-peer gets used in two ways. The first is a very loose umbrella term for things that you can go into online and borrow, lend money. So, for example, LendInvest and Zupa.
Yeah.
The second is in the more technical way, which is there is a category of regulation of which LendInvest is no longer a peer-to-peer.
Yeah. So you have loans-based crowdfunding platforms, which cover companies that facilitate loans to businesses, individuals, or against property, including companies like Zopa, Ratesetter, etc.
What about iWalker, direct lenders?
So that wouldn't be included within the bracket. And, you know, the reason for that is the other side of the marketplace, who invests. So the loans-based crowdfunders, they are permitted by the regulation to take money from individual investors, retail investors, and match that money with the loans that they originate. Whereas iWalker and other direct lenders, they lend money off their own balance sheet. The investment-based crowdfunders, as I say, they have a permission to do a very similar thing, but they're matching that retail money. It is retail money, but in some cases it's sophisticated investor money with early stage equity projects or with bonds, essentially.
So a LendInvest is which of those categories in?
So a LendInvest was very much a peer-to-peer lender, and I believe at one stage was applying to be regulated as such, but it withdrew its application. And actually now LendInvest and Christian, who you've had on the show, is quite critical of the P2P model. He doesn't think it's as efficient or as in the investors' interests as their new retail bond program. So they are now, I think, an alternative investment manager. And in addition to having a retail bond program on the London Stock Exchange, they also have a direct investment platform, but that is only for sophisticated and high net worth investors.
Right. Okay. So there's a lot in there about the evolution of the industry and away from the original idealism. I mean, if we go back to the original idealism, you can use the interweb and your smartphone to disintermediate these greedy, huge vehicles called banks, and you can connect poor young authors like you that need to buy some property in a market which is crazy with sort of wealthy podcasters like me. And in doing so in a low-cost way, both you and I would get a better deal. That was the original idealism.
That was the original idealism. And obviously there have been various departures from that, which include, you know, institutional investors, for example, coming into the mix increasingly. Actually, for the first time, I'm sure your listeners will know that Funding Circle is currently going through the process of filing for an IPO, or has filed already, actually, and it should happen in October. And they, for the first time in ages, actually published their breakdown of their investor base, a breakdown of their investor base. And I think they now have 31% retail money at play across their various platforms because they're live in various geographies, the rest of the money being from institutional investors or from the funds that they manage. They manage something called the SME Income Fund. So, you know, that's a big departure. And then I guess this latest bit of regulation that we're going to come on to talk about would possibly be the biggest departure yet from that original vision.
So sticking with the development of the industry thing before we get to the review, all 156 pages of it, because they make some good points that I myself read about several years. Of course they do in 156 pages, and they make some points which I wouldn't agree with, and it does raise the whole question of who gives them the authority to tell us what the world will be like, which is a separate point. But in terms of the evolution of the industry and the idealism, and I did actually like this whole idealism of fintech in the early days, although it was kind of inevitable, it would just become institutionalized. In the US, by and large, it was much more institutional from the beginning. In the UK, and perhaps Ratesetter is the best example still, there are people who just try and stick by the original thing of connecting the likes of you and me.
Yes.
Without huge institutions around too much, although, you know, they get involved. And I wonder, and we can come on to this, I wonder whether this review that we're seeing at the moment isn't just, shall we say, mixing all of our metaphors, a wind that comes from the regulator, which is just blowing it more in the institutional direction.
It would seem to be. And, you know, particularly for a platform like RateSetter, which is, as far as I'm aware at the moment, wholly reliant on retail money. It has flirted with institutional money in the past, but I think sort of put an end to some of those relationships. You would imagine that this will have a more marked impact than it would on, say, Funding Circle, whereas we've discussed, you know, 70% of the money comes from institutions. So, you know, perhaps RateSetter can sort of get around it and, you know, will maybe, you know, a decent proportion of its individual investors will be able to sort of self-certify and then it won't be an issue. But you'd have to imagine that not all of them will be able to, or at least a significant proportion of them won't be able to. And then what do they do? You know, they have to sort of keep the money flowing. So do they plug that gap with an institutional investor?
So what's implicit in what you've said, and it might be good to get onto some of the sort of specific details or your specific concerns that you've written very well about, and I think you mentioned that one of your articles got more comments than any other from real people out there, rather than these imagined people that the state is there trying to sort of nanny, is that one of the proposals which is controversial, or political I would say, is that, I will give the sort of simple thumbnail caricature and you can explain it properly, is that basically they're saying the plebs shouldn't be involved in this shit. You know, it's only for the aristocrats of our society. It's only for the pickety, those at the top, those that are really wealthy, well-off, mumble-mumble. You know, the people who can eat bread or the peasants can just go and eat cake kind of stuff. So that's my kind of cartoon-like picture. But what's the sort of actual...
So that's not far from the truth. So the biggest nugget from the recent review was that the FCA is proposing to subject peer-to-peer platforms to the same marketing restrictions that already exist or already apply to equity crowdfunders. So what that means is that people will only be able to invest freely, let's say, if they are number one, under advisement, professional advisement, or number two, have self-certified as a sophisticated investor, or they're a high net worth individual, which means, I can't remember exactly what, but they meet a certain threshold.
Loads of money.
Exactly, yeah. If they're none of those things, then they'll only be able to invest up to 10% of their investable assets. And again, I don't quite know what that means, but it's fairly intuitive, right? So basically what it will mean in practice is that when peer-to-peer lenders go out and try to sort of push their products to investors, they'll have to ensure that those promotions are done in a way that only targets the groups that we've just discussed that are allowed to invest freely. And for ordinary investors, they'll only be able to invest up to 10%. So one would imagine that a large number of people that fall into that category currently have more than 10% invested on these platforms. In fact, we know there are people like that because that's what some people have been saying on AltFi in our comments sections. So I guess they're going to have to withdraw money to the point that they only have 10% invested and find another home for it. And that's what's creating a really interesting sort of back and forth in the AltFi comment sections at the moment.
Not unsurprisingly, you mentioned your fiancé is a teacher, which is a noble thing to do, but she's fortunate that she's going to have some award-winning rich author as a husband, because sadly teachers do not make much money. So for example, this means that teachers are the sort of poorer of our society these days, and basically teachers will not have much money in the first place, and then they can only put 10% of bugger all in it. And frankly, putting 10% in your portfolio in something that's yielding 3% more than a bank deposit anyway is going to make bugger all difference, because 10% of 3% is 0.3%. You won't even notice it.
Yeah.
So this comes back to the constitutional political point, which, let me express it this way, which is that I understand that the FCA regulates peer-to-peer platforms. Okay, good. Right, that's what they're there to do. Right, got that bit. But they can F off as far as telling me or my kids what to do.
Yeah.
How can the FCA tell me what I can and cannot do? That's the bit that I think raises serious constitutional issues. And of course, they would say, oh, no, we're not doing that. We're merely regulating the platforms, da-da-da-da-da. But actually, that's just bullshit, isn't it? For example, you might not even qualify as a sophisticated investor despite covering it every minute of your waking life.
Yeah, no, well, I've no idea if I would, actually. I think it raises sort of two issues. And one is that people in the industry and supporters of the industry and the government, actually, have always talked about peer-to-peer
democratising for the people.
Yes, and there's lots of benefits to peer-to-peer. But one of the things they talk about is always opening up a new asset class, loans, and opening up access to that asset class for ordinary people and ordinary investors. And it almost feels a bit sort of duplicitous to talk about that for so long and generate so much buzz and interest in the industry to a certain point and then to just withdraw it. And actually, to a certain point, that point being just about the time the industry is getting to a really interesting sort of scale and the first big companies going public and things like that. You know, at that moment, it feels like they're withdrawing access for ordinary people. So, yeah, you know, I find that kind of strange. And then the second thing is about, to your point, about how can the regulator act against people? It should be regulating platforms. The other thing is, you know, in a way, I find it very strange, and this might be betraying my ignorance about how these things work, but it feels very odd that the regulator can't move against specific names in the industry. Anyone that follows peer-to-peer knows who the potentially bad eggs are, right?
It's at a point like this, I shouldn't ask you for a list of the potentially bad eggs.
And I won't give you one. But, you know, the regulator must know. And, you know, it even makes sort of thinly veiled references to them in the 150-page document that you talked about. There's a couple of pages on sort of bad practices. And, you know, if you know anything about peer-to-peer, you can go through it and say, oh, that's X platform, oh, that's Y platform. They know who they are. And yet, rather than sort of saying, you know, going knocking on their door and saying, you can't do that anymore, it seems as though they are sort of crafting these regulatory updates in order to stamp out practices that aren't happening at most platforms, but that are happening at some, but that will ultimately limit access for retail investors to what is mostly a very promising industry. And that's the thing that I find the most difficult to sort of comprehend. And I accept that it's easier to do it the way they're doing it, but I don't necessarily think it's right.
So let's just zoom up a couple of levels to their process, because having started this off about politics and philosophy, I think inadvertently, in a sense, with this review, they've tripped into the area of politics. It is a political decision to stop plebs, to look after the plebs who are too thick to look after themselves, whilst letting the rich, and let's be pretty blunt, society is bloody organised around the rich at the moment. If you're in the top 1% in, you know, Western country, you're doing all very, very nicely, thank you. And a lot of people aren't, and a lot of attention has been drawn to this inequality. So what is the process around this kind of constitutionally? Because let's say, you know, it's a draft review. They've given it to the industry. That's fine, yeah? You know, I've written lots of draft stuff in myself, passed it to other people. They've sent it back for correction. And sometimes they make good corrections. Oh, I shouldn't have put it that way. So I don't think one can fault them for coming up with some ideas, you know, and then it comes back and people say, this is political. Have you really sort of thought about it? Oh, actually, gosh. Yes, I see it can be taken that way. Maybe there's a different way of doing it. So you've made the point, and David Stevenson, Mr. Old Thigh, has made the point as well in one of his articles, which I entirely agree with, which is that if there are platforms doing naughty stuff, they should go and give them a good beating, shut them down.
Yeah.
They shouldn't do it by restricting the will of the people.
Yeah.
They might also require some education piece in there, you know, as you get with insurance policies and all this kind of stuff, terms and conditions and yada, 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 and all that kind of stuff, because I wouldn't expect that my mum or dad who are well into their 80s are going to understand all the nuances of all this kind of stuff like you are. So again, I'm very happy with that. But knowing plenty of pensioners, some have got more money and some have got less money because of random life patterns. I mean, you know, some are going to be a teacher for 40 years. They will not have made much money. It doesn't mean they're thick or stupid or need protecting by a nanny state. So what is the process? So the industry goes back and they make these comments and you know, people like you make comments. What happens next then? And who do they decide? They say, oh, we've taken your comments. Thanks very much. We accept to piss off the rest.
So the comments are due, I think, by, it's either October or November, and I can't quite remember which. So, you know, that's a reasonable sort of runway to, you know, respond to the regulator. And that's where I sort of somewhat lose a handle on the process. But I think having looked at previous papers like this, what tends to happen is they will then publish their conclusions, and in that document they will feature all of the comments that they've had, or they will at least summarise, you know, all of the comments that they've had through during the feedback period. And I guess, and this is what I don't know exactly, that they will also, you know, in some instances say, we've listened to this and we accept this. But I, you know, I don't know that they have to. I guess, you know, that's still completely at their own discretion in terms of which they respond to and which they don't. And then the only other thing that I know about the process is that there is then a sort of cooling period where everyone can sort of, I think it might be 6 months from whenever anything comes to fruition, during which time everyone can sort of take time to adjust to the new rules and do whatever they have to do. But, you know, the extent to which you can actually influence these proposals from becoming reality, you know, whether you can stop it or make it happen or whatever, as a sort of a private sector person just interested in them, I actually have no idea.
Yes, and this comes back to, and it's philosophy, so we won't get into it, we'll look at a couple more details of the review, but this comes back precisely to the point of unelected power. So writing about the East India Company, as I mentioned before, one of the challenges they had was with the monarch. You know, they were a chartered company, and that meant that the monarch had to approve your charter every now and then, just like the BBC has to be rechartered. So you had to keep the monarch on side. And unsurprisingly, monarch was arbitrary, and you know, he decided shit and said, look, it's like this, you know. So they had a, off the top of my head, 15-year charter from Elizabeth I, who snuffed it, and then James came along, and he said, oh, you know that 20-year charter? Bollocks to that. No, come to me, Sonny, and ask again. It's this kind of arbitrary authority that this country in particular was in the leadership of centuries of Parliament pushing back on.
Yeah.
And to the extent that we contributed anything to the world, one of the things that we did contribute was the development of law, individual rights, and a bunch of laws that says you won't be subject to arbitrary authority. So, and I'm writing this whole chapter on, you know, the monarch and the East India Company, and I'm writing this thinking, oh my God, what, people will be reading this thinking, what's this got to do with my small co, one of the biggest companies ever in the world and most influential, and monarchs, well, the Queen Elizabeth II doesn't have much influence over me. But the answer is that in writing about it, it occurred to me that we've kind of come full circle, that, you know, we now have these sort of state barons with their power, and it's not clear. Anyway, that's a philosophical point, but people wiser than I are starting to focus on this issue, because in the short and medium term, if regulators as a whole overuse their powers, shall we say, and it becomes more politicised, then there will be strong pushback against it. So the Bank of England has only recently fessed up to the fact that it was a bit slow in realising that quantitative easing had political implications. It had implications for inequality. Quantitative easing in this country has pushed up the equity market, which has benefited the wealthy.
Yeah.
The wealthy don't need benefiting anymore, although I did see the other day that the top 1% pay 28% of all income tax, so they are actually doing something. Okay, so anyway, so look, that's all philosophy and all that kind of thing. That's terribly important, and I think one reason it's terribly important is it's terribly important for regulators around the world, and 60% of the people listening to this are all around the world, to actually think through these issues. You know, if you suddenly made me sort of Obergruppenführer for the day, what would I do? Well, I don't know, but I would know that it's an issue. I'd have to sit down and think through to ensure that we haven't, in a sense, given political power to regulators, and they're not regulating people rather than businesses. So we mentioned this sort of the marketing restrictions, which I think are sort of, you know, one of the big concerns that, you know, kept away from the plebs. There's also this thing that David Stevenson called the category error, which is entirely right, which is lumping in equity crowdfunding platforms with debt peer-to-peer. That's just stupid. That's like mixing fish and bananas.
Yes.
On the basis they're both foodstuffs.
Yeah.
I mean, you put them in your mouth and you eat them, but they're very different.
Well, it's kind of a historical mistake, which is that they've always been under the same regime, basically just because they crowdsource something. But the something is very different. But I think what David was railing against in his article, and he was effectively railing, is that now that they're both subject to that 10% cap, although they're not yet, but now that it seems that they will both be subject to that, you know, people who, you know, the uninitiated, the people who don't know a great deal about the industry, I think will more naturally assume that loan-based crowdfunders and investment-based crowdfunders are originating assets that are similarly risky. And, you know, that is, I'm afraid, mental. You can get a very good handle on the track record of the peer-to-peer lending industry. Third-party providers do a good job of it, and one of them is AltFiData, but, you know, it's not the only one. And the platforms also do a pretty good job of representing their own track records, even if there are problems with the way that they represent it. Whereas, you know, equity crowdfunding platforms, the information out there is so scant about the extent to which they've actually generated returns for investors. Well, actually, that's not true. You only hear about the returns. You don't hear about the losses.
It's absolutely dire, the lack of regulation around equity crowdfunding. And again, if you made me sort of fascist dictator for the day, quotes FCA fascist dictator for the day, in terms of fintech, with all I know, I think my first focus would be on equity crowdfunding.
Just to add one more thing, you know, it was a huge document, as you've said. It's 150 pages. And yet it said effectively about equity crowdfunding, we're pretty happy with how that's going. And it just honed in enormously on peer-to-peer. I mean, obviously, there are things that need changing about peer-to-peer, but that seemed ridiculous.
Yes, OK, so we've got that category error. Now, one of the things that I had a lot of sympathy for, and I think they're kind of right, I didn't bother digesting all the details of it, but I'd written about, for you guys, actually, when I wrote some articles for AltFi a few years ago, was the fact that, and I was very critical at the time, that if you go to a platform, it will say, I don't know, 5% rate of return. But that isn't 5% in the same way that you go to a bank and the bank says 5% and that tomorrow you get, I don't know, 1/365th of 5% interest accruing to you. One of the things that I pointed out and nobody particularly has taken up since, and I spoke to the P2PFA about this years ago as well, and I said regulations coming, they didn't really listen either, was that's a model return, because you can know the yield of, let's say you buy 100 assets, go to funding, so you buy 100 individual assets via autobid or whatever, you know that the yield of those assets tomorrow is 5%, shall we say, but and let's say you hold it for 5 years, but you do not know what the default rate will be. And let's say you just happen to buy all assets which are 5%. What you'd absolutely know is that if you're really, 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 really lucky, you'll get 5%. But actually, it will be 5 or less.
Yeah.
So this point, the industry has still not got to terms of. And again, I suggested the fact that clearly, using the statistics they've all got, what would be much more helpful, and the FCA haven't noted this approach, it's very simple, which is that if history is a guide to the future, then your investment today, Ryan, will over the next 5 years yield you 4 to 5%.
Yeah.
If you're really lucky, it's 5. If you're unlucky, it's 4. If there's a volcano and the earth blows up, it'll be less than 4 or something like that. There's a range of returns. So I have some sympathy with the fact that if you bung money in investments like these, there is a range of returns you're going to get. The platforms quote, by and large, the upper band of that, or maybe some of them don't quote the upper band, maybe some of them make an assumption for default rates, but it's still a plus or minus. The number, the headline number, isn't the number you get. There's a kind of standard deviation around distribution. Yeah. So I have sympathy with them on that one.
Yes. So this does tie into the sort of definitions point as well. So they've come up with these three new definitions for loan-based platforms. The first is a conduit. So on a conduit platform, the platform simply presents loan opportunities. The investors pick them and set the interest rate by forces of demand, basically. And then there's a pricing platform where the investors handpick loans, but the pricing is done by the platform. And then there's the discretionary model, where both the selection of the underlying loans for the portfolios that investors buy into is done by the platform, and the pricing is also done by the platform. And that is becoming the more prevalent model. And that's also the one where this debate about target returns is most relevant. Because obviously you're basically giving investors exposure to a pool of loans and you're saying that that will generate X return over X time frame. And what the regulator is trying to do, it's basically about process the disclosure requirements. And they're trying to basically get platforms to give investors a better idea about how that return is achieved and how frequently they're right about advertising that target rate of return. And you know, my own personal idea on this, which is sort of basically drawing on those ideas that you mentioned that you've had and written about for us in the past, and also what AltFi Data does, is, you know, platforms publish a lot of information, but it's all inconsistent and, you know, you can't compare it. And also they don't necessarily publish information on how regularly they hit their projections. So what I think would be quite good, given that it's out there anyway, AltFi Data has basically developed a product that allows for like comparison between platforms. But that information is only available to basically institutional investors that can pay for access to it. So what I'd like to see maybe is for any platform that AltFi Data does that for, the platform in question could take a widget, taking some headline information verified by AltFi Data. It's the same across platform to platform, so across RateSetters, Open Funding Circle, whatever. They publish it on their statistics page, which they all have, and it sits alongside their own projections, which they've come up with as a business. And then you can see on a historical basis exactly the extent to which a platform has hit the targets that it's projected. And, you know, that for me would be quite an interesting solution to all this. But that is not what the FCA is required.
And just the avoidance of doubt, I'm entirely with everything you say there, as long as there's a plus or minus.
You know? Yeah.
So it's very easy for a computer. I buy a bunch of stuff on a platform. Very easy for the computer to say, projected return is 5, plus or minus 5, plus or minus 2. And then at least, even my mum or my dad would understand that kind of stuff. You know, it is very simple. Right, okay, so it's all work in progress. It's a little bit concerning. There's a lot in the report. Of course, we've picked out the troublesome issues here. And I think the philosophical, well, the constitutional one troubles me most, but it's a separate podcast about power in regulators. The philosophical one troubles me most after that, which is that the whole purpose, in a sense, the initial drive behind fintech in the UK was to liberate people and to be able to connect people to people, hence peer-to-peer via phones and all this kind of stuff. And that libertarian concept is running very strongly into a huge current we have in society as a whole, entirely different matter of authoritarianism at the moment, even things like political correctness. It becomes a postage stamp of consensus. Your diversity of everything other than thought, you're all supposed to believe these things and you're literally a Nazi if you go off that postage stamp. It's all mad, completely mad. So lots of things are in progress at the moment. I suspect also one of the things behind this in the UK is this Brexit thing, which none of us can stand even hearing about anymore. It doesn't matter whether you're for, against, or neutral, you stick your fingers in your ears and go la, 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 because the government has been utterly paralysed for years, and therefore, should we say, branches of the civil service like regulators just go off and do stuff. You know, several years back, 5 years back, the Treasury was paying close attention to what went on. And George Osborne was paying close attention to what the regulators did, you know, and being very clear about what he wanted from peer to peer. Without any drive from the politics of the centre, then sort of strange things start to happen and perverse things start to happen and you end up going the opposite direction. Okay, so all very challenging. Before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all of you listeners out there and my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Mitre Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT 1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages. 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out Capital.com or download the app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Well, Ryan, the table has been switched on you, or the microphone's been switched on you today, so you're a guest rather than an interrogator. And anyway, you've sort of just about survived to the end, so you've got a chance to wave the flag for your wares, which people can participate in.
Yes, hopefully a few of the listeners know something about AltFi, but we are a news and events company focusing on the fintech sector, but more specifically online lending, digital banks and digital wealth managers, or robo-advisors, as they're often termed. And I guess for those that do know AltFi, things that are new and things to be aware of, we place an increasing emphasis on the community aspect of AltFi. So check out the Friends of AltFi service, which basically allows you to, when you're signed up, sort of manage your presence on AltFi. But what it does automatically anyway is it every time a particular company, let's say Funding Circle, is mentioned in an article or featured in an event that we're running or is going to be featured in an event that's coming up or anything like that, all of that information is collated on a profile page. So in a sense, AltFi is sort of, there's an aspect to AltFi which is becoming almost like a LinkedIn, but very much focused on content rather than on sort of, you know, promotional information about a company or a person. So do check out some of the profile pages. They're looking quite good, actually. And yeah, have a look at the Friends of AltFi service, which basically allows you to do some more technical things like manage outbound links and things like that. And yeah, that's probably the next big thing. Oh, and we're doing an event in Toronto.
Oh, and we're doing one in Toronto. Easily forgotten. And you do a weekly newsletter. Actually, you do two, the UK and the international newsletters, which are one of the few that I've subscribed to for years. And every time I see you, I give you a sort of a good kicking and you promise to take action. And for lazy people like me, who've got too many in things in their inbox, that do a monthly version. I'm still waiting for that one, Ryan.
Yes, well, there may actually be news on that front imminently, let's say, perhaps from me and also from AltFi. So, yes.
Excellent. I look forward to that because there are plenty of people who do want to keep a handle on this. But some people review this stuff daily, some people weekly, some people monthly. I think that's quite a good product. And I think the other thing, which you'd mentioned before, which you've modestly not mentioned, which is that you guys also do research and specific research reports for people on that. And I think for the listeners who can't see you here, it's immensely impressive that you turned up rather like I'd like to do, with your hands in your pockets and no notes in front of you. So everything you've said is off the top of your head. And you know a hell of a lot about this industry. And for people wanting to know the industry or people wanting to come to the UK and working out what's what, I think they could do little better than turn up to you guys and see if they could pay you a few quid and be told a lot of stuff that they need. We haven't spoken about the media, but the media is changing massively, apart from to turn into a political party and promoting the postage stamp almost around the world. Actually, what is really needed to monetize this kind of stuff going forward is that you've got a huge knowledge base. Mm. And then how do you package and how do you parcel and how do you sell that knowledge base? And I think the sort of the research thing is a really good idea, which isn't immediately obvious. I mean, you know, people might say, oh, Ryan's a journalist, he writes articles every day. Yeah, you do. And you write a newsletter. Yeah, you do. But the net effect of having done that for years extremely conscientiously is you have, which is that you know a hell of a lot of shit, man, you know. And if somebody doesn't, they could do little better than pay you for an hour.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the idea with the reports, as we've kind of talked about, is, you know, as a journalist or as a new media organisation or whatever, you know, you end up inadvertently giving away a lot of expertise anyway, you know, and you have to, because, you know, you have to meet people and keep your finger on the pulse, whatever. But I think actually sort of consultancy of a kind, report writing specifically for us, is quite an interesting revenue stream for new media companies to consider. And, you know, that, I think that's the thinking behind the reports. We've done a number of them now and they've been pretty good, so... Yeah.
Excellent. Right. Well, I wish you every success in the future. And have you got a title for your second book, or have you sort of found it so painful laying an egg that you're not going to lay an egg for a long time?
Children of Empire.
Oh, God, you're doing another one. Oh no. Right. OK. And is that about sex as well?
No.
Oh, OK. Well, OK. For all of you who like sex, check out Pimple. For all of you who like empires, check out The Children of the Empire. So thank you very much. And I wish you every success in the future.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
curtain and a band there all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.